One of the things we wanted to do when we thought about designing the conference was to make sure we discussed economic viability and financial viability of food hubs. We've been talking about various aspects of it today, about mission, about values, and a lot of the breakouts have talked about financial viability, but we've got an innovative panel with some hubs and with some consultants that I think should be pretty interesting and instructive. Joining us as our moderator today is our dear friend and collaboration member, Gary Madison. Gary, until recently, Gary's been a small farmer operating a greenhouse business in Epsom, New Hampshire, so he knows firsthand the challenges of being financially viable. But on the other hand, now he's working with the Farm Credit Council, so he also knows about federal policy and about how to get those messages out and the underlying context in which our food systems are operating. So let me turn this over to our dear friend, Gary Madison.
Thanks, John. I'll get a microphone on pretty soon. In the meantime, I'll Ta-da. Try not to yell in your ear. I'm going to be moderating this session today. This was originally put together with or by Jim Barham at USDA Agricultural Marketing Service, and Jim is hopefully recovering from surgery now. He made the mistake of going out and playing basketball as a middle-aged guy without stretching first, and did some leg damage. But he was expected to not be able to be moving around a whole lot today. What you're going to be hearing is really an unscripted discussion among people who have direct experience with their food hub operations. And I'll be asking questions of our three food hub operators, and then we have three food hub consultants who will be chiming in and commenting on those answers. And personally, I'm convinced that if you've seen one food hub, you've seen one food hub, that they are all unique. And what I encourage you to do is look for the differences between the food hubs as they're described, not to choose which one's the best, but to choose which one is giving you ideas that you haven't thought about before. Look for the differences, and I think that you'll get the most out of this session. And this is structured to provide insights as if you could hear a discussion. We're going to pretend you're not there. As if you could hear a discussion between the operators and the consultants, with the extra added feature of having these guys ready to with some constructive analysis. And we all know that means they're going to be pointing out mistakes. They're going to be pointing out deficiencies in what the food hub operators are saying. And it's difficult for us as humans to recognize our own deficiencies. To paraphrase Robert Burns, if we could only see ourselves as others see us, it would from many a blunder free us. And that's the reason we have the consultants here. They're here as truth tellers, not mistake pointer outers. But these folks are in the business of speaking their minds. They're smart, incisive, skeptical, and seasoned. But they are not magicians. They are not going to be up here pulling rabbits out of a hat, giving our food hub operators the exact answer that they need. That's not how it works. What the consultants know is that it's a lot easier to change 10 things by 1% than it is to change one thing by 10%. So you're going to have to look for those small differences, those small bits of wisdom that are going to be useful to you. A couple of mechanics. I see a lot of pink cards on the tables. If you are so moved to ask a question during the session, write it on one of those cards and just raise it up, and one of the highly efficient Wallace staff will come collect it from you, and then after we get in a little ways, we'll work in some questions from the audience, and then at the very end, we'll have some open question with mics at the end. So, and also note that we're not doing an extensive introductions up here, that as the speakers speak, they will have their bio slide come up so you can identify who they are. But quickly, Sean Buchanan from Black River Produce, Sarah Lloyd from Wisconsin Food Hub Cooperative, Tony Serrano from Alba Organics, on the far end, Jim Mattson, Jim Slama, familyfarmed.org, and Kathy Nyquist. And with that, let's get right into the questions. And Tony, I'll ask each of you this one first, but Tony, please answer first. Can each of you quickly define your marketplace, that is, who you're selling to, and what are you trying to sell?
We our marketplace is diverse. We sell into food service institutions, K through 12 schools, wholesalers, wholesaler being the largest chunk of our business, and home deliveries, and basically anybody interested in product grown with the utmost integrity.
Right. And Sarah?
The Wisconsin Food Hub Cooperative is selling to retail channels, food service, distributors, and some institutions. We just have 1 year under our belt, and retail was the biggest for us this first year.
We're a wholesale food distributor, and about 75% of our business is independent retail, food service, institution, and healthcare, and 25% of our business is independent retail, natural food stores, co-ops.
So just to review a little bit, Sarah, you're in your second year of operation. Sean, you've been at it for how long?
35 years.
And Alba has been in
13 years.
13 years. So we've got a little bit of a range here. And again, for each of you, could you explain the degree to which your food hub's mission is to give farmers a fair price for what they grow? Sean?
Yeah, we actually we work very fast-paced, so we are constantly buying. We're doing direct trucks in the off-season and kind of throughout the year along the East Coast, but we do direct routes out in California. But our local season, when we come into local season, a lot of people don't know this, but Vermont doesn't have a very long growing season. It's got about 3 feet of snow on the ground right now. But when we work with local producers, it really is, hey, it's coming up, I'm picking it right now, how much can you get? And so we really stop buying from the regional terminals, and our trucks go around and backhaul product constantly. As far as fair market price, we really use price around our region as far as what's in terminals to base it, but we always pay our producers more, and if we didn't, then they wouldn't sell to us. But the relationships that we've had with our growers have lasted a very long time, and they've continued to grow as we've continued to grow.
And Sarah, fair price for a cooperative.
We are a farmer-owned cooperative and farmer-led, and certainly getting the best price is key to us. We do not currently expect a premium. We're operating on market prices. We're really working to be able to move more of our farmers' product with ease for them so that they can do more growing and less selling.
We do some of the same focus our growers on growing, and we focus on the sales part of it. We have calculated what their growing costs are for each crop and trying to base our price markup beyond that, anticipating a profit for them to ensure that they're going to stay in business over the course of time. We do go by the market, but we also do program things ahead of time via crop plans with our growers, and we get pre-commitments from our customers so that we're able to ensure that we're going to be able to move at a certain price, even contracts move at a certain price this product, so that we can at least have a cushion there for the grower to stay in business. So we've tried to stabilize that by spreading out some of the risks there throughout the season instead of getting gluts at one time and trying to simply move it. Mm-hmm.
So how does paying a fair price to farmers fit with the viability of your side of the business with the food hub, Tony?
Well, that's exactly as I described. It's just planning well ahead of time and making these commitments, factoring in our margin, but also knowing what the production cost is so key to everyone's success.
When do you start making those agreements with the producers?
I'm sorry?
When do you start doing the negotiation and the discussion with producers?
Typically a year in advance, or even as close to 3-4 months. We have, over the course of these last 6 years, we've established some really strong relationships with customers. Some we don't have to negotiate a commitment with because it's withstanding, but others we do, and it's just as far in advance as we can, the better, so that we can program. We typically like to program our crop plan maybe 6 months ahead of schedule, and then we do quarterly plans as we're going through the season, just for any changes that come into play. So the more notice possible, the better.
Is there any difference in your inside producers and your outside producers, as you call them?
There is. The inside producers, those or what we call ALBA farmers, those we always service first. So basically it's whatever they have, we are committed to selling as well as they are committed to growing it for us. We don't have a marketing agreement yet. We do have one formalized, have one made up. That was drafted by Stanford University, and we are finalizing all the details so that we can sign it between both of us. We want to give it to them so they have an opportunity to bring to their lawyer or anybody to review it, so make sure that everything is comfortable. And so, but they are first in line. We promote their product. Anyone outside of that that circle, it's opportunity. If we have an opportunity to sell it to help them out, we will. If not, there's no commitment.
And those are farmers that have been through your incubator farm process, or is there what exactly makes an inside farmer?
Some are, some are not. Some of we encourage our students always in our ag course to find their own markets, right? That's part of the training. So we, and some of them do. So once they're fairly established, we try and not make it unfair for those who aren't at a disadvantage yet by bringing them back in. Those are typically larger growers. For example, we have one that started 6 years ago with a little half acre of strawberries. Currently, he's got 80 acres of strawberries and 200 acres of broccoli. So to take him, it would be very easy for him to displace someone who's got a half acre that's just starting. So we don't want to do that because he does have a marketplace. He's just trying to get every extra bunch of broccoli out and make more money. Right. At that point, I call it, he's just, you know, he's getting greedy, but that's fine. So we do focus on those who absolutely need it. And okay, that's where we start first. So, and then I guess there's another ring beyond that, but then it's the ALBA graduates who have already found their own markets and are already somewhat established or well established. But then there's beyond that, those others that are established farms that did not go through our program, that have no relation to us aside from someone who has product that is grown the same way, that we have an opportunity to service a customer with a product that we don't grow.
Okay. And Sarah, for a cooperative, how does it fit for the operation of the Food Hub business when you're trying to do the fair price to the farmer?
Well, the co-op operates on a 12% commission on the value of the sale of the member product. So obviously the more we can sell at the higher value, then we're going to, you know, bring in what we need to run the operations of the co-op. But again, we were, you know, dealing with market prices and just 1 year under our belt. So I think it remains to be seen a little bit, you know, just how much we're sticking with the 12% commission for right now to run, to have the staff. We have a sales manager and I'm the general manager, and then all the associated costs of liability insurance and marketing and things like that to cover with that 12%.
You know, and I think one of the key areas of differentiation for local in terms of profitability is the transportation costs. You know, you ship a box of produce from California to Chicago, and you're looking at $4 to $7 a box if you're shipping it efficiently. And this is the key, is efficiently from Wisconsin to Chicago, it could be $1 or $2 a box if you've got full loads. And so, number one, we need full loads. Number two, we need efficient transportation systems throughout. And in doing so, then more of that money can stay with the farmer.
Sean, how does paying a fair price to the farmer fit with your Food Hub business?
We like it. Yeah, I mean, if you want to stay in business with people, you got to pay them a fair price. So, you know, we spend the time talking, but we also are customer driven. So, you know, there's only so much that our customer is willing to pay, and we're pretty cognizant of it. So, I mean, right now we're dealing a lot with, you know, cheese and organic milk and, you know, meat. We don't just do produce, but we have a lot of people who feel, based on their farm size, that they need to make a certain amount of money, and we understand that, but they may not be the right farmer for us. So we will really spend time with them and say, you're doing a great job, but you're 1 acre and you're 6 employees, you guys really need to sell direct, and eventually you guys will come to a certain size, and wholesaling is the right way. Yeah. So it's not as much really, you know, saying what the margin is going to be as you are a candidate who is ripe for wholesaling. Mm-hmm.
Sean, do you think that with some of the larger farms, an operation the size of yours, the array of customers that you have, can make commitments to the farms to buy more per acre so that the conversation changes from price per case for the number ones to a commitment to buy more of the seconds and find a market for all of their produce? So in terms of revenue per acre, they're ahead, but maybe the average price per case looks a lot different.
Yeah, I mean, I think possibly. I mean, we do and deal in such a tight growing window that, you know, when all of a sudden cucumbers come in, everybody in four states has cucumbers in, and the value just drops to nothing. And you can't, I mean, you can actually drive through Vermont, and people will just leave cucumbers by their mailbox, like, take all my cucumbers. I can't get rid of these. So, I mean, I think that's part of it. But when it comes into you just never really know when it's purely coming into season. I think we look more at season extension. I think we look at the utilization of seconds and value-added products. But it's still, I don't know if we're there yet, but I'm hoping that we'll move there in the future.
I think that could be an opportunity for an operation like yours.
For sure.
Where you could find different channels for everything that comes off of that field and really increase your value to the farms.
You know, pay more in the shoulder seasons for people?
Usually the market price dictates more in the shoulder season.
So you're just turning over the market price back?
The first person with strawberries and asparagus gets a premium.
You know, I think another key to long-term better pricing is differentiation. And I think Sarah's done it really well with one of their customers, Roundy's. And you go into a Roundy's store and you see, you know, local potatoes from Wisconsin, and there's the name of the farm, and there's Wisconsin Food Hub Cooperative. And so they're co-branding both the cooperative and the farm, and, you know, Roundy's making a big deal out of it. And when you've got that kind of farm identification on the shelves, there's a value perception there that long-term is going to create an impetus for other buyers to be maybe willing to pay a little bit more because, for them, they want to be associated with that kind of value.
Sarah, are you looking for an exclusive purchasing arrangement with the farmers in your cooperative, or are you encouraging them to find other markets also?
We are definitely not wanting to be exclusive with our farmers. In fact, we encourage them to have multiple markets that they can go out to. I mean, first of all, we're a startup, and most, if not, well, all of our farmer members, we have 19 farmer members now. We started with 11 last year. We're all experienced in either farmers market, direct on, you know, on-farm stands, some with CSAs. So everybody had other markets, and the co-op was a way for them to kind of pool their resources to get some extra sales and logistics and marketing done together. And right now, because of just like trying to manage all that demand and supply movement and the timing, and we're glad when people have some alternate avenues to get stuff out in case we can't lock up that sale that first week, because it takes a while to get that into the product line of the grocery store because they've got to get rid of their other source that they were.
How are you organized to not become a dump market for the farmers?
Pardon me?
How are you organized to not be the, you know, the seller of last resort, the dump market when nobody else comes, or when the prices go up a nickel, it's amazing how much product falls off the back of the truck, you know?
We do crop commitments with our farmers in advance that are, we have a marketing agreement between the co-op and the farmers, which is a legal document. We're still testing out what the sanctions are if anyone, you know, doesn't hold up their end of the bargain, but that is accompanied by a weekly commitment of how much of every crop is going to go to the hub. And so that's our base. So again, and then we're trying to get the commitments from, like, for example, the Roundy's, the grocery store chain, so that they just say, yes, we want 100 cases of tomatoes twice a week, and we're just going to let that order sit, and that product is just going to go in. And we actually held our sweet corn price the entire season because I think they were lazy and they didn't feel like changing the price because it was in their order system. And through Labor Day, we basically had the same price of sweet corn the whole summer, which the farmers were satisfied with the price that they got.
So. I mean, for us, you know, when stuff comes into super abundance, I mean, we don't, you know, we have a small population. It's 620,000 people for the entire state of Vermont. So, I mean, it's like this triangle, but half. but when it comes time to really move product out of that to a major metropolitan area, I mean, there's other groups who do it better than us. Red Tomato, we have a relationship with, you know, they're going to identify key customers out there who can buy in volume that really meet that need for our producers once they get to that scale. Or we will actually buy in bigger loads, knowing that we have produce vendors that we buy from in the terminal that we can actually sell at market price in the terminal back to them. We might not make any money, but it's the freight part of it that's on our truck going there.
Mm-hmm. Well, let's take a look at the operational side of the Food Hub distribution business. And Antonio, I'll start with you. Running any business looks pretty easy from the outside. Help us understand the inside of your Food Hub business with one example of something that's either a recurring headache or a very big crisis, something that's a challenge on a regular basis.
Yeah.
Pick one.
Pick one. Farming with a pencil 1,000 miles away is super easy. I don't know which president said that. And, you know, I do that every day. I farm from my desk and I'm saying I want 100 boxes of this, 200 boxes of that, whatever. And they tell me, yeah. But my biggest challenge has been exactly that, is just the coordination with the field to us, and, getting a precise forecast. Again, we've got commitments out sometimes as far out as 2 weeks in advance. We're filling POs instead of trying to sell it on the spot. And so that assumes we have the product. So you're talking about product falling off the back of the truck. If we sometimes have static prices with some retailers or customers, so that market fluctuates. There's a shortage. Guess what? There's people asking our growers to sell it to them, and sometimes they do. So it's all about knowledge, and that's where we've been really lax about our marketing agreement and using it. But marketing agreement is only as good as the people you sign it with if they figure out
how to. How do you enforce that when people do change?
Well, we haven't had to. I mean, and so we don't know. That's going to be a big challenge. We have a person out there who is telling us, look, the product that was supposed to be for you, they're selling it to somebody else, and then we just go back and forth. On the other hand, we're encouraging our growers to find their market. Okay. So it's contradictory. It's like, look, I need that product, but go ahead and find another customer somewhere. Sort of like, I'm just doing what you told me. So what I'm doing to mitigate that or to fix it is like, okay, let's take your map of what you have here. Let's take your crop plan. Tell me what you have committed somewhere else, because that's what we want you to do. And whatever is mine is mine. Let's stick to that, and then, you know, we'll work it that way. So my biggest challenge is getting product to my cooler that I was told I was going to have, that I told my customers they were going to have on a certain day, and then and just, you know, staying true to it. But we are things are improving. Another part to that is just my production person being able to gauge what's actually going to come out of there, because it's really hard to, even for a grower, to guess that you're going to get exactly 20 boxes out of this 300-foot row. You know, so we give it a 10% margin, but when you're 50% off, then it's just not cool. So, but we are improving just by keeping good records of production.
Sean, other than tripping over cucumbers during cucumber season, what would be your headache?
Space. You know, I mean, it's distribution has changed so much. I'll use cheese as an example. We have 34 local cheesemakers that we work with. Half of them could be cheddar. And that means every customer wants, I want this type of cheddar done in this pack size. And that means you need space to store that product. I mean, just think about restaurants 10 years ago and how many different varieties of lettuce they got 10 years ago and how many you're doing it now. Just think about romaine. It used to just be whole heads of romaine. Now it's romaine leaf, romaine cut and chopped, romaine. you know, hearts. It's romaine hearts 3-packs. I mean, it's all these things which really add. So space is our biggest headache and our biggest constraint because every customer, you know, if you're a food hub or you're a distribution company, your goal is to service your customer. And so when they call you and say, I want this, you want to make that happen, and they don't understand why you can't.
You look sometimes and say, we just can't make money on this. This isn't the line we need to be in. Even like you say, chopped as opposed to lettuce. You turn around and say, I love you, but sorry.
No, we really try to make it work. So we have special places in the warehouse where there's special codes. So on the receiving tag, it comes in one box, and that warehouse location is box in and out special code. Or we'll reconfigure the warehouse or bill of lading lines or freight and shipping, and we'll pack everything everywhere. We don't like to say no.
And do you think that that's actually a strategic advantage in creating additional value to your customers? Do you think the rest of your business is actually buoyed by the fact that you'll do some of this special handling?
It's how you retain your customer. I mean, if your customer is asking you for something over and over again and you don't meet that need, they will find somebody who is going to meet that need. So it's also how we compete. You know, we're an independent food distribution company, which means we're going to compete with a broadliner. And the broadliner says no a lot. So if you want to compete with them, you say yes a lot and you find a way to make it work. And that's where food hubs are unique is you're adaptable. You know, whatever your business model was yesterday is not the business model you will have tomorrow. And that's the unique part that all of us have as a competitive advantage is that you can be nimble in the marketplace.
For me, another key is post-harvest handling, maintaining the cold chain, food safety. Every single buyer that we work with, and at this point we're working with just about every large-scale buyer, and certainly in the Midwest, they all want those things. And they want consistency. They want quantities that are promised to them. And oftentimes that's falling short. So, you know, how are you guys dealing with those issues, in particular food safety? Because at this point now 80% of wholesale buyers, if you're not GAP certified or moving in that direction, certainly having a food safety plan, they're not buying from you. So, you know, what are you guys doing?
Is that a concern in your markets, Tony?
It is for sure. We went so far as just 2 years ago deciding, and thanks to Wallace, center here, is that we needed to do a food safety plan for our entire operation. We embedded it now into our ag course. We are food safety certified for individually all of our growers, and as well as the warehouses, and applied all the traceability, all that good stuff, because we knew it was coming, and we knew that we were going to be the target of someone like FDA, who, by the way, did stop by in our warehouse to check us out on a surprise audit. Ooh. It's like, cool. So
yeah, sure, that was that.
So they showed up and, you know, flashed his badge, and I had to stop what I was doing, sit down, and open the books. And
speaking
really
of headaches,
cool.
Yeah, cool.
Right.
Was exactly the word.
I had no alternative. It was like, okay, let's do this. So we know that, because even for CCOF, our organic certifier, we love them and whatnot, but they straight up told me, it's like, you're going to be a target all the time for surprise audits just because of the nature of what you do. We deal with so many small farms, okay, who are inexperienced, and they're getting trained, and so they're going to make mistakes, and I've had surprise audits from them as well. Fortunately, because we've been working ahead of schedule on this, we've done well. We've gained some respect, I think. And so that kind of eases everything, allows us to move forward. It's a big concern.
How do you work to help to mitigate that audit or make sure you have that relationship ahead of time?
With just getting those things in place,
yeah.
As we start doing the research, is you know, we hired somebody to create our policies for food safety. We have basically, it's an internal auditor. We have someone full time who is, and our farm ranch manager or incubator manager, it was actually a former food safety auditor. When he came to work for us, he was a food safety auditor. So that really helped. and so it's just making some of the right decisions at the right time, and knowing that you're going to be a target. It's like, if you know you're going to get kicked, then you know you get a chin guard or something.
So if you're going to marry poor, Mary Rich, Mary Rich.
Yeah. Yeah. Sean, do you have any kind of internal audit for food safety?
We use third-party audits a lot. We do internal audits as well, but we own and operate a USDA meat processing facility too. Oh. So once we went to that stage, I mean, they just pounded us enough where we got it through our head that we needed to change. But it's way different. I mean, back when we started, we used to be in a barn that we never locked, and it wasn't even refrigerated. And I mean, we tell this story all the time. There used to be this raccoon who would climb downstairs, and it would suck the bananas out of the skin. And then the co-op would call us and be like, "Man, you guys ate all my bananas." And we're like, "No, the raccoon ate all the bananas." And they'd be like, "Great, send me another case." And the raccoon would do the same thing. And I mean, that's food safety 20 years ago. It's just non-existent.
Get arrested for that now.
Yeah.
Oh, are you being horrified by this, Sarah, as far as what you're getting into?
Well, we definitely are, as this coming out of this first year, knowing that we have to move quickly on this. We have some of our growers who are already GAP certified, Good Agricultural Practice certified, and we're working with everyone to use templates among our growers so that we all have the same stuff. And that's a service that the co-op is offering to the members to assist them. But the farmers themselves have to obviously take a big initiative to get it to happen. And I think, you know, we're thankful for what we can learn from the groups that are piloting some of the group GAP certification that's kind of being looked at. We want to know how that's going to work because we'd love to get in on that if that makes sense. And I think, obviously the big dilemma is you can only be audited when you're in the actual height of the harvest. So it's like they say, well, we don't want to buy from you unless you can prove that you're GAP certified. But, like, I can't get GAP certified until I'm actually harvesting the product. So, you know, that's a big dilemma. And I guess you just have to try to run. What's that, where they're trying to change the tire while the car is driving down the road? Sort of the red-green show had a thing with duct tape. And anyways, I think that's about what we're trying to do right now. But we'll see what we can do.
So as far as business operations, how do you know that you're being efficient? What are the key performance indicators that you have? And I won't ask you first, Sarah, because you can play off the other guys here. But Tony, how do you know you're doing things efficiently? What do you, as the manager, watch?
Well, spoilage is always a factor. Waste. If you're wasting a lot of product, a lot of good product, then you know there's something wrong. Sales. You look at your numbers every day. If your numbers are down when they should be up, that's a good indicator. P&L, we run a P&L every day, too. I have an in-house office manager that is doing that for us. So it's just gauging all the areas that are key to your viability, but at the same time, just dealing with growers and asking them if they're making money. But one thing that helps us too is knowing their production costs so that we know that we're within range, because you can be within that and you can be paying high dollars to your growers and they won't be making money just because they're not administrating it right. So we have a business module within our ag course for the same reason, as you need to manage your money when you get a production loan. Is don't go buy a new truck. You got to buy your plants, you got to buy your fertilizer, you got to keep money for your irrigation parts, for all these things, fertilizer. And so it's just looking at all the key areas. But you got to identify them first. You got to know that these are the areas, the indicators that you want to look out for, and just comes over experience and over time, and being able to see those and consistently be looking for any changes. So, and then profits. If you're making too much money, then you don't take a vacation. You figure out why you're making too much money. It's like somebody, if you're gaining too much, somebody's losing it. So, in our case, it's just trying to make our growers successful, be fair. So it's just all those things.
How do you do when it doesn't work?
What was that?
When you're measuring it and you see that moment, like that, what was it? Oh, good. What was your, when the inspector comes by. Oh, cool. Yeah, that cool moment when, suddenly you're looking at the P&L and it isn't where it's supposed to be. How do you respond?
Well, first of all, you got to be honest about anything, especially with inspectors, because they've been there, done that. They know if you're if you're BSing them. So if you're wrong, you're wrong. And then you assume the consequences as you fix it. You know, I've been wrong before. We've been in situations, like, for example, with our latest food safety audit, glass in our warehouse, an area that we don't need. We need to keep a log for that. Somebody has to check off every day that, that it's not broken. The previous audits that we've had, it wasn't a requirement. It's just, we specified that, that area wasn't anywhere near product or production. And so, but rules change. And so now you gotta have something like that. Well, we didn't know. We had proof that we didn't know, but we told the auditor we didn't know. And so she dinged us on that, said, meaning took points off, not a whole lot, didn't fail us because of that. But then you get corrective actions, the opportunity to correct them. We created a log, we put it into our plan and presented it to them, got it corrected, and now it's all good. So honesty always pays off more than trying to be cool and Mickey Mouse, the whole thing. It's just nothing against Mickey Mouse, but you just gotta, you know, just play it straight. That's always worked for me, and that's what we've done.
Sean, your key performance indicators.
Yeah, usually by 8 o'clock a.m., every category that we carried, so like refrigerated products, cheese, meat, produce, conventional, organic, by 8 o'clock every morning, we get the night sales and then the gross profit above real cost. And every buyer gets that. Most of our upper management team gets it, and we just start going through. And if anything looks fishy, then we stop and we all start going through the numbers and see what's going on. And then we do monthly evaluations, and then we constantly look at efficiencies. Where can we invest in efficiency? Because you always got to stay ahead.
Do you tie
performance to those metrics? Do your team know what they're responsible for delivering?
Yeah, almost every department at our facility is incentivized with a bonus plan, whether it's weekly or based per pick or, based on an annual sales bonus for inside-outside sales. Yeah, everything is incentivized. We found that offering people more money, just offer more people more money is something, but offering more people with deliverables is probably a better investment.
Sarah?
Well, we have lots to learn, and I think, you know, certainly our biggest challenge in just getting things off the ground last year was not having all the systems in place to be able to track, you know, and I was doing all the bookkeeping, and I was sticking PLU stickers on pumpkins, and I was, you know, helping the sales manager. So, you know, common problem, I think, in a startup, and we now in this lower activity period are trying to get all the systems in place so that we can do. Having a daily thing would be great. Weekly, I think we can do for sure.
Baby steps.
Yeah.
Great. I have a technical question. Can I stop looking at my clock? Is this countdown clock the right time? Okay.
That's for the whole session. So.
Thanks.
If you want to do questions,
Got it. Well, I got a couple of questions from the audience. The first one is for Sarah. Have you found that any of your farmers that were selling at farmers markets have cut back their reliance or participation at the farmers markets because they now sell to you?
I don't know if that's happened yet, but definitely when talking with our members, we have a couple that do 5 farmers markets a week, and their goal is to cut back on 2. And so when they are giving us their crop commitment for the year, they're saying, if we can sell all of this through the hub that we're committing to the hub, then we won't go to 2 of those markets. So that's definitely in their thinking. We encourage farmers markets. Wisconsin is really lucky. We have really insanely popular big markets. So we don't feel like we're taking away from the vitality of the farmers market. We're just offering another market channel for farmers.
And for Sean, does it make sense for Black River to work with a co-op that aggregates from smaller farmers?
Yeah, we work with co-ops. I mean, we work with Cabot Cooperative. We work with Deep Root Organic. We work with co-ops. Sometimes it's really easy. Sometimes it's not really easy. It just depends on the relationship, and it depends on the expectations of both parties. So whether working with a co-op or working with an independent producer, both of them have expectations, and if you find common ground, then it works. And if you don't, you go your separate ways and, you know, come back to talk again.
Right. Well, so we've got a better idea of operations now. I'd like to turn our attention to issues that are about facilities and equipment. And maybe the easiest way to get a handle on this topic is to write each of you a check for $100,000.
Oh, yeah. A million.
And watch.
Oh, what about this side?
Yeah.
If they want to use a percentage,
we'll give
and you may want to suggest that as a possible.
Okay. I was going to say, you
wait
can
your
write
turn.
One, too.
So if I give you $100,000 and watch how you spend it in your business, and it's an imaginary check, I know you might think I have a lot of money, but I don't. But how would you deploy that money, Sean?
I'd pay down my debt. That's what we do every day. Whatever money you have, pay down your debt so you don't pay interest on it.
So you're increasing working capital.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, because you can always borrow off of that capital, but you can't borrow as much off of debt. I mean, there are tons of bells and whistles that we want. I mean, let's admit it, like $100,000, let's buy new software, let's buy new pallet jacks, let's buy new trucks. But, paying off your debt is key. It keeps you on top of it. And if you can stay ahead, if you're taking your profits and putting it back into your business, it makes you feel more comfortable taking risk in the future because you know there's a better return on it.
Sarah, where's your money going?
Well, I appreciated Jim's comment about transportation, and certainly as we develop our markets, trying to get those full loads coordinated, and what we want to do and what we're implementing this next season is these routes of direct store deliveries to the independent grocery stores, but it may take a while to get to that full truck. So if I had some money to kind of pad my trucks as I went out into that marketplace and took the time to build the route and the customers, then that would get me into a better position on the other side. So I would use it to subsidize my initial transport into those new customers and new markets. Thank you.
And Tony, you mentioned Mickey Mouse before. Was that trip that you want to do with the $100,000? Is it?
First of all, I triple that and then take the trip because then it makes no sense. I think the area we need the most at is our warehouse. We can save an extra $100,000 a year, probably more, because we're paying like $12,000 a month in rent. Where we're at in Watsonville, plus an additional three staff members that are just duplicating work in Watsonville that we would save having them in Salinas. We would get a matching grant for that $100,000 to get for our facility and save an extra $100,000 on the labor that we're going to have there and increase our space and reduce our energy, maybe go solar or something like that. So I would triple it, and I'd cancel the vacation.
You mentioned the grant, the famous G word. Do you think about the cost of the grant or the application time or the process? Do you calculate that in when you're doing a grant application, or do you just...
Well, in our case, where you're saying what you invest to get something like that. In our case, we've been doing it so long that we've got an idea of who's supporting our operation and who likes it, and so we invest our energy and focus in that, and you know where we feel being more effective. So wherever there's in other words, it's like repeat business. It's somebody who has been supporting your program, who you've delivered good results to.
So you have a high return rate.
Exactly. They're more than likely to continue to give you grants. And then there's obviously others who are certain areas, like now that when we needed help with food safety, it was something different that we were doing before, but there was the opportunity. We could present the need, and it was given to us. Then, right now we're looking at a grant for the facility and some capital expenses there. So we need a new well. We need to deepen our well with our drought. We have a shallow well, 300 feet. So we go another couple of years. We're atop a very lush aquifer, so that's not a problem. But we are shallow, and all the wells around us are 1,000 feet, 1,200 feet, pumping 1,500 gallons per minute. We're only pumping 500, and they take away, 200 of that when we get shallow. So that's a no-brainer. We got to do it. So for those types of things, we're applying for a grant right now, and we're trying to include the facility. So if we got a $100,000 grant, then, you know, we probably venture it somehow. I'm not the financial expert, but that's what I would do with it.
How about Sarah? I am. You're on the startup. How about the grants for you?
The grants. That we have a pretty active debate in our board as to if I should be spending time trying to find grants, and we kind of go back and forth. We did get a USDA value-added producer grant, which is very helpful. That came out of a business planning process that we had some municipal support for, so they helped with the grant writing. But I do actually find that administrating and getting the reimbursement for the USDA value-added producer grant, is there anyone in the room that does it? Why can't you just give me the money? I'll tell you how I spent it, but why do I have to get reimbursed? Because it is a cash flow issue. So, I mean, think about when you're looking at all these different grants and stuff, I think it's really important to think about what it's going to really take to get a hold of that money and report on it. And yes, it's really welcome and it's really helpful, but yeah, how much time do you have to deal with that? It's a good question.
So, Sean, I'm not trying to talk you into buying a thing, because your answer of paying down debt is great. But if you turn that into a thing, because you were talking about lack of space being your problem, mm-hmm. how are you looking at when do you invest in that space?
Well, you know, you try to use that space as long as you can. You know, so we've been securing property over towards our meat processing facility. So we're in the process. We've already secured 12 acres over there. Our distribution facility is 53,000 or 57,000 square feet, and we're trying to, in the next 5 years, build 125,000 square foot facility that can facilitate a lot of freight for us, but build it in a design where we can always add on to it, and we have the property to add on to it. So that's coming down the pipeline. But, you know, utilizing the space that you have, a lot of us have space constraints, and we realize that we do a lot of things manually. So software is a big one for us. So we have a big investment in new warehouse technology that will allow us to do warehouse transfer, lot tracking, everything barcode in and out. Individual accountability for every person who moves a product, picks a product, can be tracked all the way through from everybody who adjusts an invoice or puts a line item on there. That part of accountability has always been a problem with our company. We're always meeting a couple times a week, and it's like, who did this? You know, this went out and it wasn't supposed to go out. They're like, I took care of it. It was fine. And that's like the end of the discussion. And meanwhile, there's somebody on the phone just screaming at you. So something definitely went wrong. But, you know, software efficiency in warehousing is definitely a big one that I think a lot of us will be looking into in the future.
Is that something that you can grow into, or you have to look at a software system with the barcode that it's just an absolute ramp up all at once?
It's really painful when you get to a certain size and you have to implement software change. When you're at a really small scale, it's okay, and it's okay to make mistakes. But, you know, we start packing trucks at 10 p.m. at night. The first one's out the door at 11:30 p.m., and all the trucks are packed by 4 a.m., and it's 35 trucks out. So when we make a mistake, it compounds itself, and it's really problematic. And, you know, we are kind of worried about new software and how we're going to implement it. But for us, it's a year-long planning strategy and training before we ever get to the point of going live with it, mostly because we've been to enough plants who just decided to flip the switch and it didn't work. And one of these companies was $1 billion in sales, and they did, you know, milk, and they were getting like 5 trucks out a day. So, that was like a month. So when it goes horribly wrong at that scale, it goes horribly wrong at that scale.
Now, you mentioned using the $100,000 check to pay down debt. However, you know, on your slide, it mentions that you just put in a $10 million processing facility. It seems to be the opposite of what you said you do with that money. What made you go into that go, no-go decision for that large investment?
Well, take, for example, the processing facility. We're building a USDA meat facility. We bought the original Ben & Jerry's Peace Pop factory because it was abandoned. And the town wanted it to bring jobs, and we wanted to bring jobs. And so we built it as a very small meat processing cell in this enormous building. And then once we felt like we had the sales, we were going to expand and expand. Now we've realized, like, we need to fast track to make it a slaughterhouse processing value added facility to really stabilize itself in the marketplace, but also offer that service to the independent producers who are in the region because they don't have access to that. When we talk about the larger markets, not only for us, but if you're going to a really small regional niche plant, can that person produce and package your meat so that Target will take it? In the majority of the time, the answer is no. So we're building that. But to do it, you know, it is $9.5 million worth of debt, but we also took all of our profits from the last few years and paid down $5.5 million of that debt already.
Okay.
So it will open June 1st to the next scale, but we, just like the $100,000 example, we really do pay down debt because if you compound that over 30 years and amortize it, you know, you're paying like $27 million. So it's a lot of money that you're going to pay it in the future, or you can just, you know, maximize it right now.
Let's shift gears again here to social mission, and that's a defining aspect of what a food hub is. And the expression of that sense of mission is reflected in the structure and governance of your operation, of your business. Tony, I'm wondering if you can tell us about how the social mission flows from the governance of your organization to the line, front line of what you do in the food hub.
Well, our board members are overseeing our mission, making sure we stay true to it. They're constantly monitoring it, and they're, you know, they got mixed feelings about whether we should help more people that are outside of our program, and others say we should just stick to the ones we have. Some say we should turn a profit so that we can invest in more land and open it up for more people. Others say no, we don't need to turn a profit. We just need to break even and keep and keep putting it back into our program and make our students successful. So we definitely stick to the social part. We grow growers. That's our motto. I like to say that the product they grow or that's grown there is the byproduct of what we do. Actually, our focus is the social part of it and turning success stories into reality, or turning people into real success stories, I should say, is what we focus on. That all sounds beautiful, or to me, at least when I hear it, but it's far from being beautiful in the process. So there's an argument going back and forth and questions about, you know, whether we should really do this. Some say Alba Organics should just not exist. This is internally because of the liability it poses. We've been growing very rapidly. We do own the land. We own, you know, facility, all that stuff. So at board level, they're concerned that if ever something went wrong or somebody just woke up in the morning and said, hey, I'm going to sue Alba because they might have some money, you know, it might be a potential risk or with food safety if somebody gets sick and they decide to go after that. We do hold a very high insurance policy. And but still, the question remains there is, should Alba exist or should we send these growers on to someone else to do the distribution for them and whatnot? My response to that is, if we really want to be do-gooders and we really want to help people out and whatnot, it's hard to send somebody to a well-established distributor all these headaches at once. Because what we're doing is we're fixing a lot of these problems there at ground level. As it's coming into the farm, we're looking at it in the field, we're correcting it, we know there's going to be these problems, these issues. You send them to someone else, they're not expecting any of that, or they don't want it. So they're going to reject it, they're going to discourage these farmers, they're not going to be able to farm or be successful. The reason they are successful with us is because we do babysit that. We hold their hand throughout the process of the first couple of years until they actually get comfortable and move forward with their operations, and then they gain the confidence and can operate on their own. So I say we can't function without Alba Organics if we want to really make growers until we get our systems in place to such that it's a no-brainer. You give somebody a manual. This is what you do exactly when this happens, and if the weather takes a turn and, you know, you get hail, this is what you do and this is how you fix it. Well, I don't see the, I don't see that. So we're very socially inclined there to advance people.
Sarah, your mission?
Yeah, this is really interesting question because the Wisconsin Food Hub Cooperative came out of a process in Dane County, Wisconsin, which is where Madison is, and these folks over here were involved in a lot of the feasibility study, and the, you know, the plan was to have lots and lots of small-scale farmers aggregating, you know, a couple cases here and there into these larger loads. And we figured out, at least for who was sort of at the table and the capital that was available to us, that we needed to kind of take this really lean model, and we needed to go up to the growers, and everything's relative, like medium-sized growers, people that have 100 acres of sweet corn and can put a whole semi-load or a half a semi-load of sweet corn together in two pallets of cucumbers at a time, because that was the only way that we could sort of get moving fast enough to move enough value to kind of have some staff. And we, it has been problematic to some extent because people, because we have not been able to service the small-scale growers in the same way that our vision and mission articulates, but I always tell people, I'm on the 2 to 5 year plan on that. Like, give me a little bit more time. Give us a little bit more time and we'll be, you know, we'll get the flows moving and we can sort of bring the smaller scale folks in, babysit or help some of the folks get up to be able to produce for the needs of that wholesale market. And so we, you know, we started with the folks that were already in those markets and knew how to produce the USDA number one stuff in the right size cases and could put it together. And that was our strategy to get moving. But I have become a avowed pragmatist in all of this and actually taken a lot of comfort in going back and reading my pragmatist friends so that I can know that I have a vision, but I have to check that with the structures and the reality on the ground, but I can still keep moving with that.
So. I just want to congratulate you for getting to that point and sort of underscore it for the room that that is the path to stability so that you can accomplish the mission. And I work with teams in all different shapes and sizes, and there's always so much heart and desire to help the small and beginning farmer find a new, more stable market. And I use the expression, put on your own air mask before assisting others. You've got to get yourself healthy and able to support yourself before you can offer, extend that to others. And so I know you sometimes take it on the chin because it isn't, you know, why you were, I mean, I was there at the very beginning. It was all about helping those smaller farmers find new markets. So it can be a tough conversation, but the 2 to 5 year strategy is the way to have the conversation. Like, we're going to get there. We just can't do it yet. Yeah.
Sean, how does governance flow down to, and mission flow down to what you do?
Well, I mean, we, first of all, I mean, we have, you know, about 150, 160 employees. So paying them a really good wage with full benefits, with 401ks, health care. I mean, that's, you got to do that because, I mean, they're the people who work so hard to make the business viable. So there's that component. On the producer side, you know, we look at New England in particular as we're a huge importer of food. You know, there's very little food security for where we have. At one time, we had great food security. So as we work with individual producers and really identifying the ones that can scale up efficiently and are looking for new markets for their products, it really helps us solidify food security. And for us, I think the biggest social mission is to find somebody who currently is not buying a local product and to work with them and integrate it into their menu or into their school and university or into their program where they say, moving towards a local system makes my staff feel better about the food that we're cooking. It's a healthier alternative for what we're doing. We're proud of the work that we do. The food has a name. It has an understanding. It has a story of where it is. And being able to connect that end user with where the food came from, I think, is a social mission that most of these people share.
Talk more about that meeting, because I think that's a fascinating. What does that meeting look like when you go into the restaurant or go into the distributor? You know, you finally got their attention and you have them trapped in the closet. So you've got, you know, that 10 minutes. How do you?
It's not 10 minutes. You know, it's more like 2 years, maybe a year. You know, and that's it. Like, you know, don't burn your bridges. You know, go out, have that conversation today, because eventually it connects. It resonates. They get it. And it's not now, but it could be the future. And when it finally clicks, then they call you and they really ask for your assistance. But, you know, do you want to sell as much local product tomorrow to this person? You don't know if it's going to bankrupt their restaurant, or do they have a plan and a strategy for what products make sense for them and implement it? So the key fuzzy feeling for you is when you can go to a place. You know, I'll use a guy who worked for me. It's got a guy named Ian Heisinger. He's a great chef. Ian's like a total grumpy dude. He owns a bar called Bar Antidote. He was my sous chef, and he was like, local schmokel, this is just whatever. You know, the product's inconsistent, the cryovac's broken, you know, blah, blah, blah. I mean, this guy's raising his own pigs now. You know, he's got his own produce farm. You know, this is 7 years later, where the idea of local from him was like, screw it. Why would, you know, it's just another headache. And now it's such a part of intertwined how he does business that you look at him and it's not just business growth. It's personal growth.
Okay.
That this person now understands the food and where it comes from.
We're going to stay right here. Don't worry.
We had the mystical moment. Yes.
And is invested in it. And then that means his 5 staff will become invested in it. And those 5 people will be another 25 people who are invested in it. And it's this this effect that just keeps going and building. And that to me is the greatest thing.
So,
no. Go ahead.
Go ahead, Jim.
I think the social mission aspect of it really hits across the stakeholder chain on such an amazing level. We've been working with Chicago Public Schools for the last 5 years on procurement. And, you know, now they've got a really good system. In fact, Kim Much is here with Farm Logics. And, you know, they're a regional food hub. I think you guys are going to do, what, $2 million this year with CPS. And it's not only great for the farmers, but the kids are getting to know the stories of the farmers and understanding, like, what's going on with their food and who it's coming from. Last week at our trade show, Mayor Emanuel was there, and he riffed for 5 minutes about the fact that Chicago Public Schools is buying antibiotic-free chicken and how important that was, and, you know, that, you know, we're national leaders in doing this. And, you know, it's hitting at really high levels. I think Secretary Vilsack is at an event in Chicago today, again, talking about local food procurement. And, you know, this is good for everybody. It's good for all across stakeholders. And to me, that's hits each of our social missions.
So I know I'm supposed to be asking you guys questions, but for the consultants, if you can, most people would assume that you're called in and it's numbers, right? And or operational efficiencies, or measure something, save me some money, help me plan the future. How often do you get called where you see that governance, not to pick on co-ops, but we know it's a problem there, or a young startup organization, how often does governance become part of the problem that is really affecting the business?
Every call. It's usually the thing that's swept under the rug and people want to move. The first question people always ask is, well, can you get me a grant? Followed immediately by, when will the check show up within the process? And a lot of times people skip over whether or not they should apply, which is sort of the earlier question, but also dealing with that structure and the issues before you have a problem. And back to the honesty issue that Tony was talking about, being set up to know what it is so you know you have that problem, is often a governance issue, just being able to set up the structure, because you know, back to the values and what you're doing, what you measure is what people perform to. And the governance drives that all the way through the institution. In fact, the question I would almost throw back is, how do you deal with that balance of reporting the numbers and your mission back to your board and members, back to your group, you know, that sort of, you know.
Look, let's stick to this question, but remember that.
Well, for the projects that we work on, we're very early stage, and often they're organized as LLCs. So governance is a little bit, you know, it can be loose at that early stage. And then I think in some cases that's helpful. Where I think this comes into play in the work we do is that often it's working with loose coalitions of stakeholders who come together because they want to undertake a project that can change their local food system, and they all bring a lot of heart and different skill sets and sometimes different goals to the table. So we often do have to sort through competing objectives among those stakeholders that share the outcomes of the projects that we work on. But I think the process of doing that can be very helpful in catalyzing a common set of objectives across a group of diverse stakeholders and helping them understand that sometimes the things that they feel that they're not going to let go of, they actually must if this has any chance of being successful, to the point that I underscored that Sarah made about shifting the mission a little bit toward anchor growers that can really help get some volume moving efficiently. So, but I know that in later stage organizations where there is a formal board of directors, choosing the board is incredibly important, and converting the board from startup to mature operation is also incredibly important. And bringing in people that have more longstanding business experience, bringing in people that have broader networks for being able to build the business can be very important in getting a startup from that point of just, you know, being crazy ass, get it done in any way that you can, to a much more planned out long-term horizon, planning horizon kind of operation. And I bet you've gone through a transition like this on your board a few times as you've grown your business.
We don't have a board. We have a board of two. We have two owners, but we do meet we meet all the time, and it's really an open forum for ideas. You know, at the end of the day, like, you know, the owners make the call, but they're actually two people who really listen, and we think about things, and we don't rush to conclusions. We just wait, and then when it feels good, it feels good.
You know, I think the Wisconsin Food Hub Cooperative is a great example of the community stepping up in a process where, you know, Kathy and I worked together with the community, did the early feasibility assessment, and then it's like, okay, we want to create a food hub. And then it's like, all right, who's going to operate this, and how's it going to get done? And there's this whole period of complete uncertainty. And then, you know, Farmers Union stepped in and said, well, you know, we're a stakeholder here. We represent farmers. And then next thing you know, it's a farmer-owned cooperative. And, you know, with the leadership that they brought to the table, it got done. And quite honestly, without that, it wouldn't have gotten done. And so I congratulate you guys for stepping in at a really critical moment and taking it over to the top.
So back to that question, who's got a good answer to the reporting them? You're out because you're only reporting to two guys, and they can do rock, paper, scissors, or however they make the tough decisions.
It's brutal when you give them the wrong answer.
But how do you report back up mission success along with the metrics of the business?
Well, we have monthly meetings just with all the board members, so we have to present our progress and projections and, you know, where we're at, what we're seeing, any changes, whatever. But the financial committee meets every 2 weeks, so they're more on top of, they want to know the numbers and whatnot. So it's just whatever it is at that point, that's what it is. If typically our winter is when we go in the red for a few months, and then we come springtime, then it changes, as long as we don't dip too far in the red. So we already know how much we go in the red typically, and we monitor that. It's like, okay, you're going too far. It's like, what do we need to do? And so sometimes we mitigate that with outsourcing a little bit and brokering some more stuff, or kind of, you know, just to keep it, or shorten the hours of operation if it's because we just don't have, there is no product. Like, we had a big freeze in December. There was no product. So what was the point operating, so we shut down for a couple of weeks, and that people still got paid because they had vacation time and whatnot, but at least we weren't running the trucks, we weren't running the coolers and all that stuff. So again, it's just monitoring, but we have periodic meetings, and you know, they buy us lunch, and sometimes the lunch doesn't taste good at all. It's just they can be very unpleasant meetings, or they can be very good, depending what time of year it is. So I like to go in the summer meetings. I hate going in the winter meetings.
When in your lifespan did you start that with the finance committee? Did you, I mean, was that from the beginning that you had that governance?
No,
back to the evolution of governance.
For me.
Yeah, back to you. Back.
No, we've been tightening up on a lot of things in the last, like, 3 years.
Okay.
It was really loose. We, you know, trusted everybody. We loved everybody. If we lost money, it was okay. Not really okay, but, you know,
right.
You'll do better next time kind of thing. Now it's no. It's,
okay.
We're getting too big to just handle it that way. So the board got really serious. They're out on the farm a lot. We've added more board members, all different areas and backgrounds, from lawyers to CPAs to people who are CEOs of some major food service distributors and stuff. So there's plenty of seasoned people in different areas that are participating in there. So we're having them very often, and they're very, very organized. You know, and of course they come with some really, really good questions.
Comment on
well,
that, sir?
I'm a definite student of process, and I think, like, there's lots of jokes, especially about co-ops, you know, it's like meetings and meetings and meetings, and if you come late, you're on the board, and you know, so you gotta watch out. But I think, you know, our strength is we started with 11 members, and our bylaws call for 7 farmer members on the board. So almost everybody in the membership was on the board, and we had a really, really hands-on board, and we still do. And we meet a lot, and we talk a lot, and we email a lot. And so that's good. But, I mean, my big thing in being the general manager is actually making sure that I can create those spaces for the meetings to be as productive as possible. Mm-hmm. So bring snacks. I'm the snack person. But, you know, really, like, funny things, like finding a good spot to meet. And, you know, because everybody's coming from all over the state to meet for these farmer board meetings. And so, you know, just being able to create the space where people can meet and get the background materials, but that you can't shortchange that process and the importance of having the space for everyone to talk. And because we have our farmers, we're people that are and were in competition with each other. And now they're in a business together. So you've got to have a lot of trust, and you got to talk it out. That's the end of the story.
So we're going to use this opportunity for a short commercial break, because I have lights up here I can read. We're talking about measuring the difficult to measure, and I want to point out that tomorrow there's a breakout session, getting to the triple bottom line. Another one, measures that matter, which is about how to set up measures, and in the afternoon is a session called Finding Common Measures for the Nation's Food Hubs. So it's a significant and difficult topic, but it has severe implications, I guess is where I go. So a couple of questions from the audience, and we'll get to the microphone questions pretty quickly here from the audience. So keep thinking or keep writing as your will moves you. This first question is, well, maybe it would be for you, Sarah. When you don't have a customer for the product you agreed a farmer would grow, who takes the hit?
That's a good question.
Do you want me to retract that question?
Yeah, I don't have a good answer. You get really nervous and get some more gray hair. And, I mean, that's the challenge, especially in the startup. I mean, we've got trying to line up all the different buyers, but it doesn't always fit, especially when you're trying to deal with climate and temperature changes, and the cucumbers all came at one time or didn't come at all. And I don't, we do not know the answer to that.
Sean, do you have to deal with this specifically? Are you going out and arranging?
Under promise, over deliver. You know, so if you make a commitment, make sure that you can move it. And this happens all the time now. I mean, there's a lot of new distributors and new people in the marketplace, and you know, everybody's got big dreams. But you know, if you don't have the history and you go out there and say, I'm going to do this and this and this, and it doesn't work out, it really wrecks your credibility. So we really try to make legitimate commitments, and then when it's a new product or something else that we're not familiar with, we never make a projection. We just say, let's see how it shakes out. But it's, you know, when we pick up a product from somebody, it's not on consignment. We bought it. So if it doesn't move, we eat the cost on that.
Tony, do you have grower standards for production, and how do you implement those?
We do. The implementation part is difficult. There's specs. We deal with you know, the specs for kale are pretty much the same for all the retailers and wholesalers. So we find those informations on the internet. Most importantly, you talk to your customers and ask them, what's your specs? The big chain stores are the best to target to get that, because they're so specific, like they break it down to the millimeter and all that stuff. So you take that information back to the field. Before we were starting into a crop, before we started with strawberries, we hold what's called a clinic, and we bring all the strawberry growers together. We go over all the details. This is what we need. This is how. This is what we're going to do, etc. And the message there, the take-home message, is we're going to crack down on this quality as it's coming in. So if you don't do this quality, then it's going to get rejected, and we reject product at our dock.
Now, take it in a slightly different direction. What about things like labor standards or organic standards?
Everything's organic, so it needs to meet the requirements. We calendar when the certificates are expiring a couple weeks before. We're collecting that information. Same thing for food safety. Liability insurance, we handle that at program level. We're like workman's comp and all that. All of our guys are required to have, by certain years, because we hold an umbrella policy and we hold an umbrella certificates anyways for everything. But it is a requirement that in their second or third year, I believe, that they have workman's comp. They have their own organic certificate. They have their own liability insurance, all that stuff, and they cannot renew their leases if they don't produce these things. So in our case, it's probably easier to handle these things because we got some leverage to work with. We can say, look, you're not going to continue forward if you don't do this. So in other situations, I imagine it'd be more difficult, but and that's how we've been handling it.
And Sean, a different question. Tomorrow's plenary session focuses on cutting-edge state-level initiatives for food hub development. Could you speak to how a public-private partnership with the Vermont Working Lands Enterprise Board helps you access new markets and create jobs?
Yeah, actually, this year this was the first year we ever applied for a grant, and we did it for a couple reasons. I mean, we're a big enough company, but building this meat processing facility. We looked at the market need, and we looked at one piece of equipment, which is a roll stock machine. It's like $150,000, and it puts meat in really pretty packaging that mainstream consumers want. And we specifically wrote a grant for it because our plant isn't just our stuff. It's every individual producer's one that's written into our program, and it's a fee-for-service processing plant. So basically it would allow any producer to be able to get the type of packaging that's going to be required for a mainstream market. And in a way, we just felt like the state should be connected to it. We felt like it was a win-win for them and a win-win for us. It lowered the cost of the machine. But also, you know, we didn't want to just do this thing without them. Our state partners are really integral to our business. We spend a lot of time with the nonprofit groups around the region and with the state agencies. And we all have the same goal, which is let's find more markets for producers. Let's allow local food to grow together. And we wanted to connect them to the project.
Great. So let's have some questions. Chad's holding a microphone, but Chad, you're not allowed to answer any questions. Jeff has one. If you have one written down, you can read it. And Lindsay.
Hi, this is mainly for Sean. I know that you guys are doing rebate now with some of your larger distributor customers.
Yeah, I love rebates.
Yeah, I'm curious if you could talk about why you decided to do it, whether you feel like there's been a return on, investment is the right word, but return on choice.
Yeah. Rebates. Oh, God. That's so great. Yeah, basically, the world has changed to where you give somebody a product and a service, to where you provide a service or product for a management company, and then they get something on the back end. And it's everywhere in food service now, colleges, universities, it's there. It's just, if you're going to do business there, that's where it is. Do I agree with it? I don't always agree with the philosophy, but when it's spelled out very clear, you do the risk assessment and the analysis and say, is it worth our time and energy? We have one primary company that we do a rebate program with that's food service oriented. And the reason it works is because they're easy to work with and they don't send stuff back. And if you short them something, they're fine. Okay, so they're what we call our ideal customer in a way. The rebate part sucks. They're not nice, but they're an ideal customer because they're low maintenance and they pay on time. Okay? And that's the customer that you want. So for us, when we evaluated the rebate system, it made a lot of sense. One of the areas that we have giant concern, and I'm not going to get on a big soapbox and preach, but we talk about affordable access to food, and the rebate system that exists in this country for K through 12 education is ridiculous. Okay? We personally do not focus our time and energy on K through 12 education because the majority of school systems in our area are required to buy 95% of their product from a food service distributor so that they can get a rebate on it. And that part of us is really problematic because most kids who are disadvantaged are going to eat at school. They're going to eat at least two meals a day at school. And because of the rebate system, the access to local and fresh foods is not there. In the communities, I mean, we all see this around the country, your school board votes and says we need to raise more money, and everybody's like, nah, we're good. But this part of it, people don't understand that the K through 12 school programs in particular are all on an incentivized rebate program and are basically incentivized not to buy local food. And that is disproportionate with the values that our communities hold in this country.
Another question.
I have a comment, I guess, Sean. Okay. So the 95% of product that they have to get through their existing contracts, what's the opportunity for you to channel local food through those existing distribution channels? It doesn't go on your truck, but maybe you can let someone else carry it and you do the sourcing?
Well, distribution works as in when it's advantageous, it's enough money for you to stop your truck and pull boxes off. So we may get a bunch of calls from a K through 12 school saying, you know, I want a case of local lettuce. But to stop a truck and pull one case off, it's just not going to work.
What if it's not your truck, though?
You mean run it on somebody else's truck? It's possible, but then, you know, where is the margin for that to be made? That distributor is not going to do it unless there's a margin for them to make. So if that person stops off or we drop off at their warehouse, there's a cost associated with that, and then they have to resell that product, and there's a higher cost. So there's a higher cost to getting something which is within their community. I mean, our ideal world is not saying K through 12 should buy through us or anybody else, but K through 12 should have the freedom to buy, to be basically given a food budget and to be accountable enough to spend their food dollar wisely. Okay? I mean, all of us go to jobs every day and are held accountable, and to say, you have to do this because we don't trust you, we're going to make the decisions in a boardroom, and that's what's going to dictate the food that our kids eat, I think it's ridiculous.
Another question out there. Something you want to ask the consultants? For free. Is that okay? Short answers.
Well, I have one to throw back out. Is, I think you alluded to each of you sort of strategic partnerships that you have with other firms. And you talked about Red Tomato, the grocery store, other folks that have funded you in the past. How do you, I mean, How does that play sort of in your day-to-day business where you're still trying to pack pallets that day or get, you know, how do you work that in? You're just your day-to-day operations of building those relationships that help that each you were talking about, you know, without even really thinking about it while you were talking.
Not me. I just think of for our funders, our deliverables, is are we doing what we said we were going to do for this money? So we're always looking at that. It's just identifying, like, we have different grants are specific to different areas of our work, so we have to commit certain amount of time to that. Now, the idea is when we apply for them is that we're already doing this work. We just need some support for it, right? So it's just make sure that you don't deviate from that. You keep track of it, and the reports reflect what you're really doing on that. And then in terms of relationships with other customers and growers and whatnot, is just, again, staying true to what you're telling them you're going to do. If you're telling them you're selling them organic product, is you need to be very sure that your growers are doing it like that. So monitoring the inputs, fertilizers, water, you know, all the tests that need to go behind that. So we have people that are doing that, but again, it's supervision. Is you got to supervise your professional help too. So it's just going back and forth on that.
I think that the relationship building obviously is, I really like the title of this session because the mission is really that we're reimagining and recreating and reinventing the food system. And what happened to make it non-functional was that we lost all the relationships because shipping anonymous commodity food around the world doesn't give us any kind of social thing to grab onto. So, I mean, all of the relationships are really important, and obviously you need to have a business relationship with people, but, you know, if we can't build relationships that support the farmers, then there's, you know, we would like to get into a position at the Wisconsin Food Hub Cooperative where we can be a little bit more choosy about who we sell to. You know, right now as a startup, we're just kind of trying to get in. And then, you know, there's two sides of it. I can hope to sort of push what I can expect from my buyer and how they need to be treating the farmers, the co-op. But then if they don't, then I can move to a different buyer who's willing to kind of get into that social contract with me about what's just and what's fair and what's good. But again, we're changing the tire when we're driving the car, so it's sometimes hard to do that.
Duct tape. Wasn't that red green
solution?
It's
all about duct tape.
Well, I'd like to recognize that we've been here for quite a while. Thank you for your attention to this. I hope you got some of those bits of wisdom out of this. I certainly learned things that I didn't know, and appreciate that. And I'd ask you to show your appreciation for our consultants and our food hub growers.
Thank you, Gary.
So next is, I'm not sure that's on, curbside consulting. If you're doing that, check the registration desk for where you're going, the name of the consultant, and the room that you're assigned to. Those names are also on the rooms that they're in. So please enjoy those. It's dinner on your own tonight. If you're looking for a restaurant, check your app. It's under the other information. And enjoy, and we'll see you here in the morning for the next plenary. Have a great night.
That doesn't
Thank
sound
you.
Really good.
That was great.
Thank you.
Sure. It's nice to spend time with you
great.
Like this.
Yes.